Hi, I'm just going to make a quick introduction, and then we'll get to the main event tonight. My name is Christopher Shannon. I'm the director of the Washington Composers Forum, and it's gratifying to see you all here tonight for a very exciting presentation. Just have a couple of quick announcements. First of all, I'd like to thank Jack Straw Productions, who is the co-sponsor and host of tonight's event, Composer Spotlight. You can find out much more about Jack Straw Productions out on the front desk, a lot of exciting events coming up, including one that we were fortunate to be involved with, the Composers Forum, which is a very well-known instrument builder and composer, Trippin, MacArthur Fellow, and is graciously donated his Clavier Nonet instruments for the Jack Straw New Media Gallery. And those are 9 toy pianos which are controlled through MIDI interface. And we did a call for scores where Trippin selected, I believe, over 20 pieces. And we're very excited about that. And that's going to be, the opening is going to be January 16th here at Jack Straw. And there are cards out in the front, so you can get them and check that out. It's going to be a very exciting evening. Trippin is also going to be coming in February to be talking about his events, his upcoming projects. He'll be explaining a little bit more about the Clavier Nonet idea. So I hope you'll turn out for that. A couple other things. There's a concert that's coming up in town called New Music for Bassoon, and that's on Sunday, January 12th. And that's an afternoon concert at 3 p.m. at Breachman Auditorium on the University of Washington campus. And it's $10 general admission, $5 students, seniors, and Washington Composers Forum members. Very exciting concert of local, all new music, local composers for both bassoon solo and bassoon with electronics. So you think you're going to hear something interesting, I'm sure. One more quick thing is that there is the Seattle Opera is doing a promotional discount for their opera Don Pasquale, which is going on right now, and I copied off some flyers for that. So if you want some discounts to get some last minute opera tickets in the Mercer Arts Arena, you can also find those at the front desk and help yourself to food and drink at any time. And now I'd just like to very quickly introduce Ila Lamblin and Leah Mann. I had the opportunity to actually see their work some years ago at their studio. It was very exciting. It combines both choreography, very imaginative use of theater, also found objects and created instruments as well. And I think they've really carved out a very special area for themselves in performance in Seattle. And this is all ties into an upcoming show that they're going to be doing it on the boards. And I hope they'll talk a little bit more about that. And right now, let me get out of the way. Please introduce, help me welcome Ila Lamblin and Leah Mann.
Hi. How about everybody takes a big breath? We've got our big show coming up, as he mentioned it, on the boards, the 17th, 18th, and 19th. And that one is a little stressful, so we're trying to make this one really, like, friendly and low-key. My name is Ila, this is Shelley, and this is Leah. And we call our troupe Leela Vision. And our upcoming piece is called Rhythm of the Landscape. And for this piece, we took inspiration from the rhythms of the natural world, the seasons, the migration patterns, rhythms of the rain, the water, kind of, we chose some of the rhythms and used those for inspiration in our piece, both choreographically as well as musically and rhythmically. So we're gonna start with a piece.
Should we warm them up first?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. So we've been trying to do really tricky things, like, and our technique, what we generally do in performances to combine 3 things. So we play instruments, we play on the instruments, and we play around in the playing area. So we're trying to dance and play music while we animate a sculpture at the same time. So lots of things going on at once. So we've been practicing a little bit of brain gym, and we'll just share a little bit of that with you so you can be really warmed up before we start. So everybody point one finger forward and stick your other thumb up. Switch. 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 See how quickly you can switch. Okay, pat your head. Rub your tongue. Now Now rub your head, pat your tummy.
But my hair.
Much your hair.
Yeah. All right, with one hand, draw a triangle. We've been practicing this sort of thing a lot, so polyrhythms in the body. So here you have a triangle, a rhythm of three. And with your other hand, see if you can now start drawing a square at the same time. It is possible. We keep trying.
So now you see how hard it is to do several things at the same time.
Yeah.
So when we mess up,
that's just the beginning.
Yeah. Usually we assign particular, so ensemble, he would, in our ensemble, he's doing a three, she's doing a four, and I'm doing a five. So we have just a little bit of preparation to get into our drum kit here.
So this is a behind-the-scenes look. No one ever gets to see this actual part of the preparation.
Shall we commence?
Not only were we studying polyrhythms for this piece and a technique called Takatina, which is stepping, chanting, and clapping patterns at the same time, but we also transposed an Indian tabla composition onto our bodies.
I saw a man flying three stunt kites with his hips and his hands, and this reminds me of that.
Doing what?
Stunt kites.
He was,
controlling
how many stunt kites?
It was three.
Three stunt kites. Like with his hips, his hands.
Great.
Let's see, his hips, one hand, and one hand. So that's another
maybe we need some musical.
Musical
kites. Yeah.
Sounds like
that would be good.
The Chinese,
then
of course, have been
really
doing that
fast,
for a long
back
time.
And forth across, or get a wind machine.
Bigger budget. Oh no.
Let's see.
Look at our leg bells. Oh well.
Are we ready?
No, not ready.
Thank you.
it got warm fast. So, unfortunately, because of our the small space compared to what we usually need for performance, we couldn't bring many of the pieces that we're doing in our show, but that is one of the pieces condensed into about a quarter of the size we normally do. Normally shooting across the room as we do it, but for fear of colliding into you and ourselves, we decided to do it in one place.
That's right. Lots more movement involved usually. So,
so we'd love to. We're going to kind of do a little bit and talk a little bit and do a little bit and talk a little bit. So, if you have any questions already, feel free to jump in right now and ask some. And any questions?
What's the visibility like behind the drums?
Ah, it's about zero.
Big zero.
We can
yeah.
see
yeah.
kind of down and peripherally a little bit, but it's pretty difficult. We have to choreograph very carefully to keep from colliding.
And then lots of tape marks on the floor when we're locomoting a lot, so we don't fall off or hit curtains or the wall.
Yeah, question right there.
What's the sequence of learning a piece like that? I mean, it's obviously many, many memories involved. So where do you start, and at what point do you add the movement and so forth?
Each of us kind of do it a different way, because I'm not schooled in music. I learn everything spatially, and so I remember it as choreography. When we play larger instruments, it might be the string that's to my right and the highest, so that's how I designate, or the one that's by my foot. So it's all very visual and spatial.
I've been studying classical Indian music for a number of years, and that's of course taught orally through syllables. So most of our rhythmic foundation that we start with is taught through syllables, and you probably heard us saying the syllables as we go. There's also a form called Takekina, created by a man named Reinhard Flatischler, and Leah and I studied with him a little bit and brought some of that form and taught some of those rhythms to Shelley to kind of integrate into the piece. And then also we took, as Leah mentioned, a age-old tabla composition that the Indian piece was kind of based on this tabla composition, and so we took the syllables and divided the drums up into, you know, the high and low sounds according to the type of syllables, and then we just kind of transferred it to our bodies. So we kind of do a combination of learning it as choreography and speaking syllables for some of the more like architectural rhythmic elements.
We did actually spend a lot of time just in the studio practicing those 3, 4s, and 5s against each other, just clapping and saying that to each other without even thinking about the choreography. So there was a lot of rhythmic work that was done there. And then we layered on top of that what we could do choreographically. So then at some point it just becomes the same thing. Fuse together.
And start editing it and piecing it together.
Yeah, we do say that we're doing the southern drawl version of an Indian tabla.
Can we do that for him?
Sure, are you in?
Just a
do
little.
Do our ditte?
Yeah.
So the syllables that we're saying, and you'll notice we're doing it a little slower then.
Here we go.
A ditte, ditte, dogge, tette, tiradet, tette, dogge, tette.
That's like dog.
I'm from the South, so I feel D-A-W-G. All right about making fun of that.
We've just performed in Atlanta, so we got a big kick out of that. Southern drawl tabla. So, like, I think most of our work kind of comes in layers like this. A lot of times it's the invention of the instrument that has to be the first step. And even with these, the idea to wear a drum on the face as a mask came years ago, but never kind of went anywhere for a long time. And then we kind of thought, well, maybe it's time to try that again. And we had done a little bit with it, but never kind of worked out. And then Shelley was in there, and it was like, well, we got to have more than just the face, you know? And so we're thinking about adding the boobs, but. But so, and it kind of is meant to be humorous and fun, very light. All of our work for the most part is based in a kind of playful approach to making music. We're not overly careful with it.
Precious.
Yeah, it's not overly precious to us. So.
And this is just one section of the full evening piece that we're working on, that actually is done, that we will be performing next weekend. So this is one little facet, as if looking at a prism from all different ways, where this is one section that represents a certain type of rhythm and work, and then lots of other instruments that we're working with, completely different take on a similar idea.
A lot of the kind of basis of the musical and compositional phrases we're using are still based in this polyrhythmic interactions, but other things that we're using in the show include some really long aluminum rods that are played with rosin gloves, and they make this beautiful singing tone. We each have one and hold it and play it. And we have a tree that is a steel tree that has these pieces of stone. They're tuned slate, and we play that kind of xylophone-like, playing the leaves of the tree.
Hiked into the Cascades on the opening day of hunting season to rescue the slate.
We've got what we call the volcano, which is a big metal volcano looking thing with strings all the way around it. Kind of sourced some of the ideas from this instrument, but it also spins around and it also ends up sucking two of the performers down inside of it or erupting again. That's right. So it's a spinning, stringed, bowed, plucked, hammered volcano instrument. And
simply put,
we've got some things we call the thunder wings, which are
bird puppets.
Yeah.
That we play with mallets and pound on the floor and wave in the air, that do that big thunder noise.
Kind of like a thunder board, mm-hmm. but it's mounted as a wing on a stick, so it looks like this bird puppet, and it goes walk, 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 walk.
All too large to bring in here, but.
And
then the biggest one is a 30-foot by 18-foot harp. So it spans the room this way, and the strings hang from the ceiling, and they're weighted by river rocks that we rescued from rerouted riverbeds.
It's played with the longitudinal vibration, kind of like a long-stringed instrument, and played with rosin gloves. And the rocks hang, the rocks that are weighting each piece of music wire hang in an arch, kind of like a rainbow. And two performers play it at the same time on this metal bridge that allows us to get up high enough to reach all the strings. And
how do you pluck the string?
They're not plucked, they're rubbed.
They're rubbed, right?
It's a longitudinal vibration. It's the same with the rods, different than most stringed instruments, where instead of the string vibrating up and down, it's vibrating forward and back, which means it follows a completely different ratio of size to pitch. So very, very long strings or long rods actually make very high pitches.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And the final thing we didn't say was we're also doing bungee drumming. We have a drum kit that's in the air. We're connected to bungee cords, and we bounce, and we are
fly through the air.
Aerial drum kit.
How do you rehearse that?
In our studio.
In the studio.
Short segments of time, so we can walk later.
A lot of our stuff is pretty physically demanding. So, did you have a question?
No, we will not.
Okay. So those are some of the things. Yeah, you
make all of your own instruments?
Yes, I have made everything that we use. I didn't make the frame drums, although I made them into what they are. So put a lot of effort into them. But other than that, I've made everything that we use, and most of it is very, very unique as well. I mean, there might be instruments kind of like it in one way somewhere else in the world, but nothing exactly like what it is. And I've composed and kind of improvised, come up with all the musical scores for the piece as well. And we work a lot in ensemble, taking kind of rhythmic ideas or things together and improvising with them. And because of the physical nature of the performance and Leah's choreography that she brings to it, there's this kind of trade-off between the music and the movement, and they don't always just like fit. So a lot of times you have to leave out that part of the music because it just doesn't work physically with what's going on. And sometimes it's the same. It's like you've got these great dance phrases, but you can't play while you do them. So we're constantly working together to try and figure out that balance. So I like to say that, you know, it's all about kind of what your situation is and what your intent is. So if you were to compare, you know, these drums to a tabla player of great stature, it wouldn't be very good on just that pure rhythmic level, not very accomplished. Likewise, if it was just a dance piece, it would be not quite there. But we're like bringing the two together to make something new. And because of that, it's the best that it is. I mean, it's the best in the world of that sort. Which is the brilliant thing about making your own unique things, is there's nothing else to compare it to say, oh, it's this good or this bad. It's just what it is.
But we also have a saying that we should never let the fear of being bad at it ever stop us from trying. It's a company motto.
The key to it.
So the description for the fusion of the dance and music, in simple terms, is what Leah and Ela like to call physical music. So sort of the phrase that's been coined around the combination that we're doing.
Yes.
How many years have you all been working together, and how did you meet?
Well, I've just been working with these folks for just under a year, so.
We've been working together about 10 years, Leah and I have.
That started in the traditional sense, like he was accompanying my dance in the orchestra pit.
And then we started kind of getting more in ideas, and I was not trained at all as a dancer, and Leah wasn't trained as a musician, so all of the complementary disciplines that we've learned, we've taught each other. So over the years, we've been able to really share a lot of our own talents with the other person. And so it kind of gradually grew from more traditional musician accompanying dancer to kind of like people dancing and playing music together simultaneously. Should we do another?
Thank you.
Yes, I do, although it's played with harmonics, so of course the harmonic series is untempered,
right.
So the strings and their relationship to each other are tuned tempered. Yeah. However, you can play it untempered by playing the untempered harmonics.
Right. Yeah.
And of course with pitch bending, you can do any sort of relationship. So, but yeah, I started out tuning it. Actually, the story about this instrument, I made it as a musical sculpture. I call it the stamen phone, like stamen of a flower. And it's, I knew it was, you know, an instrument, but I didn't really know how to play it. And I was playing it like a bowed harp, where each string is one note, and which is basically just the lowest octave that I was using. And then while I was taking a physics class, I was studying Pythagoras's monochord. And how he deduced the Western scales and modes from a one-stringed instrument called the monochord. And I had kind of this idea that I could use harmonics on this instrument. And so with that, armed with that information, I went back at it and I redid the tuning of the strings and the order in which they played in, and kind of made up my own map, the harmonic nodes. Primarily, I only use the octave and the fifth and the second octave and the second fifth, so on up, because they're the most resonant and most tempered one. So it really was a process of discovery after I made it, and then it went from being an instrument of one octave to an instrument of seven octaves. It goes so high, it's unpleasant. And so then I've spent the last 10 years kind of figuring out how to play with that. And about 6 years ago, I noticed that the sound of it is resonance, and partially because it vibrates sympathetically with itself. The strings, it's tuned in two halves, one half acting as sympathetic strings, and in this case I was using this Ebo to create a drone on one of the strings on the opposite side. And so it resonates sympathetically, and I thought that was really evocative of Indian music. I've always loved that type of music. I decided I better really learn to do it if I was going to pretend like I was going to do it. So I found someone, Jeff Lewis, to teach me. He's studied with Zia Dagar in India for the Drupad form. And so he spent years helping me kind of adapt that music to this instrument. Yes?
Why do you tilt it?
It's got a little bit of water in it, which is subtle, but it is there. And also it provides kind of this better angle to approach it. As Leah said, it was designed initially to suspend from the ceiling. And it didn't even have this bass on it. I added that later. I discovered that if your instrument requires you to hang from the ceiling, you don't get a lot of important opportunities, such as this one. So I put a bass on it, and I mostly play it like that now.
How heavy is it?
A little bit too heavy is probably what I should say. It weighs about 109 pounds. And I had no idea when I made it that it would go to 5 countries, which it has. So if I made it again, I'd probably try titanium or something instead of these thick pieces of solid steel. But it's all recycled material. I didn't have to buy any of it. Yeah.
So I was wondering, what was the spine in its first life?
Ah, the spine. It's fabricated, purely fabricated. Okay. I just made it. I made it by taking long pieces of rebar and wrapping them around a whole bunch of them around a tube and welding it all up and then removing the tube and putting on this. And I chose that just, I liked the kind of DNA look of it. So
very cool.
It's purely an aesthetic choice. It really has nothing to do with the sound, the center. This is cast bronze, and I melted down a propeller from a boat and cast it out of bronze. These are made out of 2 stainless steel solubles, TIG welded together. The rest of it is pretty much assorted bits of scrap steel that I found. I made my own tuning gear, and that is always a big part of making a stringed instrument, is coming up with an appropriate tuning mechanism. As a piano tuning mechanism, this is piano string, it would just not work in this situation, so I had to make my own tuning system out of little bolts. And I change the strings about once a year, and occasionally they break, but not very often.
The steel strings?
They're steel, and they're under a lot of tension. One interesting thing is when I made the instrument, all the strings are the same length, and they do vary by thickness, but the variance in thickness is not that great, not nearly as much as, say, a guitar. That means some strings are under a lot more tension to gain the pitch that I need than others, which are very loose. And while I thought that was a flaw in the instrument, right, mostly the conventional wisdom says the more tension, the better tone. However, this is the very tight one. Wait, is that a good question? Let's see. And this is the very loose one. Not same pitch, but a lot of tune. The quality is very different. They're same pitch. And I discovered that what I thought was a flaw, that, I couldn't have all the strings as tight as they could be, and I was kind of using the piano as my correct method, right? Actually turned out to be quite a creative tool. Not only that you get this different kind of smokier tonality out of it, but also that you can do great pitch bending on the loose strings, which you can't do on the tighter strings at all. So, it just goes to show you that when you're making instruments, the conventional wisdom doesn't mean that that's the only way to do it. Yes?
Were you sculptor first and then musician, or musician first and then sculptor, both? Can't remember what
I was
started
a musician
both.
First in that I was a musician as a very young child. I played violin since I was about 5 or 6 for a number of years. And I was an artist all my life, and I went to college studying sculpture. And while I was at college, I just started making my sculpture assignments instruments. I don't know how it happened, it just started happening.
And so the rest was history.
Yep, and then I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. So, and at the time when I was in school and doing this, I was pretty much just doing it all on my own and had no knowledge of the kind of whole history of instrument inventing as such that is out there. And then I got out of school and I started working and finding out, I started going, I better educate myself a little better on this. So very familiar with all those people like Harry Partch and John Cage and various.
But are you glad you started off with more naive in the
way? I think definitely. I think there's, you know, it's like Leah said, you can't let being bad at it stop you. You know, you can't let, you know, thinking that, oh, that will never work, stop you. So being naive can sometimes help a lot.
Well, in the beginning, and then you keep getting better.
Yeah, exactly. I think at some point you start to trade naive, but kind of like extra creativeness because of that, for a little more wisdom, a little more like the correct way to do it. It seems like it kind of goes that direction usually. But that's good, organic way. Yes?
Did you say you're using any electronics in the piece?
We are not using any electronic music and no amplification.
No amplification.
And I'm somewhat of a... no, you're talking about our...
Yeah, I'm talking about your piece.
Yeah.
Is it on the boards?
Yeah, on the boards. I'm pretty much a purist about amplification. Mm-hmm. I really prefer not to use it unless it's just like they can't hear it, you know? But... there's plenty of amplified music out there.
Oh, yeah.
And there's very few people who are dedicated to providing acoustic sounds. And since, you know, what I have here is something that's very unique sounding, it behooves it not to compare it with all the synthesizers. And if I don't run it through an amplifier, it helps it sound. It's much a finer tone that you can hear with your ears, you know. So
I imagine it carries well in the big hall, doesn't
it? Yes, it usually carries quite well. The low end depends on the size of the room. The high end pretty much carries in any room. But a really big room, the low end can just get sucked up. Kind of depends on the frequencies you're using.
What are some of your favorite acoustic places that you play these things in? I'm curious.
Susie, you're the one to ask about that. I should be asking you about that.
No, for
this?
Yes.
Well, I actually like smaller rooms usually because of the low end response, like I was talking about. But I did get to play it in St. Mark's Cathedral, and that was very nice. So I'll say St. Mark's is one of my favorites.
About the case also being a huge amplifier.
Oh yeah, that's a funny thing. We've been touring all over the world with this stuff, and so I have to. Most of the pieces I make now, which we couldn't bring because they're too big, they all get assembled. They're all like bolt together instruments. So when you get there, you've got to take days setting it all up. This one doesn't come apart, so I made this big coffin looking case for it.
Oh. We painted it purple so people would know it wasn't actually a coffin.
We were in Edinburgh, people would be like, look out for the coffin! So I was doing a lot of street performing over in Edinburgh with this instrument, kind of advertising the show and selling CDs and such. And I discovered that if I took my big wooden plywood crate and turned it on its side, it made this great resonating chamber for all my low end. So.
Yeah, he sticks the xenophone on top so it just shoots the sound out.
You see me street performing anywhere, you'll see my case under it set up there, making use of the...
But for that to work, you have to remove the dead body, right?
Right. Yeah.
Do you ever use that on stage as well?
No, it's... When you get right down to it, it's not a very quality low end that it provides. It's kind of rattling. It's street low end. It's great for like going over a lot of noisy cars and stuff, but for the most part, I hope the acoustics in a room and the quietness will make up for it. I do amplify this sometimes. This more than most instruments. It actually responds quite well to amplification and is very different. It's much more punchy and low, but not quite as sweet sounding, I would say. And it's been a challenge to record. I've got, you know, several CDs out, and I like the recordings, and they're obviously well recorded and everything, but I just can't reconcile the tone quite with the tone in the room. Like, it just never is quite there. It's like, I don't know what that is. I guess that it'll always be that way, but.
What about lighting? You know, a whole lighting scheme for your piece also?
Yes.
A pretty
involved lighting. And also, we're doing video projection in this piece. Taking the idea was to kind of combine some of these visual rhythms found in nature and project them on some of the sculptures and the backdrops. Not as like a film that leads you through, but as kind of an accessory to what's going on in the piece. Yeah, it's very environmental, so.
Is it recognizable objects or is it abstract?
Yeah, it's raindrops falling in kind of polyrhythmic relationships, leaves, migrating geese.
Windblown sand or bark.
Yeah. Kind of these patterns and visual things. That's very integrated with the lighting design. That it makes a huge difference. I mean, just to the kind of moods we're evoking. And
yeah.
It's really nice to kind of, you know, when you combine the movement and the color of the lights and the mood of the lights with the music, it can definitely be a different experience. It's no longer a blank slate. It becomes something.
Even just looking at your instruments under lighting would be good too.
Yeah, and the great thing about metal, and most of them are metal, is that it responds really well to light. They turn all bright colors and very fun in that way. Yes?
I was wondering about the little bells. They look like little old-fashioned bicycle bells.
Yes, close, but maybe this will ring a bell. Look, yeah, they're taken out of old telephone bells. They scavenged the Goodwills of Seattle. Got all those old 70s style telephones, the rotary dial, and got all the phones out of them. And I actually did some tuning by grinding them down. You can actually move a bell both directions in pitch. You can raise the pitch by shortening it, and you can lower the pitch by thinning it. And I like put it in a drill press and sand the side of it while it's spinning so it does an even thing. So I did a little bit. This one I specifically tried to tune it microtonally. I didn't worry about any scales. I just tried to get them close to each other so that it does all that those weird sounds.
How about the chimes? How are they tuned?
The chimes, I've got a great story about that too. They are tuned to what would be a crude Western equivalent of a Balinese scale. And the fun thing about this is we went to Singapore last March, and we were asked to collaborate for the Singapore Children's Festival with the gamelan ensemble, LaSalle Gamelan Ensemble in Singapore, and it turned out to be truly quite well tuned to their instruments. And what was really remarkable about that is that each gamelan is tuned to itself. They tune all the instruments to each other, but you can't like take this gamelan and put them together. It doesn't work. They'll be like off, not tuned to the same exact frequencies. So it's really a stroke of luck that this happened to be tuned to their, I believe it's Pelag scale, and I played a solo in one of their compositions with that.
We also have a big one that we ride. The tubes are all around us, and we spin, and then we can raise and lower the bells, and we strap mallets to our hands, and we play while we're spinning.
Yeah, I think there's a picture of that one. I call these instruments, this is the one that spins around and we ride in the center of it. So so the whole thing spins. I call them Rumi tones, and they're named after the poet Jalaluddin Rumi, who is the first whirling dervish. So I decided that Rumi tone is a classification of instrument type, specifically one that spins around. So I would really call the bell wheel and this instrument a Rumi tone. Even our vial Kano I was talking about, it spins around, it's a Rumi tone as well. The spinning instrument.
So they should call it the Rumi instead of the Leslie?
Yeah, exactly. Definitely.
Have you made horns of any sort?
I have in the past. Let's see. My wind instrument forays started when I was a teenager working with seaweed kelp. And that's actually one of the first instruments I made. I'd always, you know, played them as bugles kelp. That's an easy one. But one day I was on the beach and I thought, you know, I'll bet this would make a good flute too. And so I like took it and used a rock and like punched some holes in it. Worked great. So I made a bunch of those. And then I discovered that, not only is kelp great for flutes, but truly it is good for woodwinds because it provides a conical bore. And if you know the difference between a clarinet and a saxophone, is mainly that a clarinet has a fairly straight bore to it, while a saxophone has a very conical bore. And that allows the harmonic series not to leave out the first harmonic, this conical bore. And so I made some woodwind instruments based on that principle of using this conical shape. And I have a trade secret for working with kelp, which is that to get a perfect piece, I find a whole piece that's already dried on the beach, but it might be like kind of caved in or wrinkled or folded, and I soak it in the bathtub. And then I pump it up with air with a bicycle pump. And then I let it dry all expanded like that. Okay. So it's like all perfect. And then I like make my instrument out of it and then shellac it. I haven't done that in quite some time, but I spent a lot of time making those. Then recently, as in a year and a half ago or so, I made something I call the pandemonium. It's kind of like a harmonium, but it's a pandemonium. And it works, some people might call them bolophones, these things that have a little vibrating rubber reed on the end.
Diaphragm.
Yeah. Right, a vibrating diaphragm. And I made an organ out of these sorts of things. And the way it works is it has all these plastic tubes with little vibrating membranes on the end. It's all plumbed together with plumbing parts, and it has two industrial strength toilet plungers that act as the bellows, and you pump up these giant punching balloons, and it's all attached to a boat, and this boat is made to rock back and forth. And you pump up these big balloons, and those become your storage chamber, and as they deflate, mm-hmm. you can play your instrument.
Oh, and the keys are hose heads.
Made out
so
of
like. We're playing with our feet while we're on the boat.
When I was developing that instrument, I consulted with Trimpin, because he is definitely the genius of this sort of stuff. And he was very kind in sharing with me all the things he'd done of that sort that didn't work. He would say, don't bother this, you know. So he kind of got me a head start. And one of the things he said is, this type of thing is low pressure, high volume system, which is the opposite of most. A compressor would never work. It's high pressure, low volume. So I kind of abandoned thoughts of compressed air in any sort except a punching balloon. And it's certainly flawed again in that as the balloon deflates, when it gets down near the end, the pressure actually increases for a little bit. It's a little, it's kind of constant for a while, and then it's like goes. So right at the end, you get this ascending pandemonium in your sound. Fortunately, it's a clown piece, so it works fine.
How about Bart Hopkins? Do you know him, or have you ever collaborated
yes.
with him?
I haven't collaborated with him, although I would call Bart a champion of my work, and he has done really nice things for me. I've written an article. For those of you who don't know, Bart Hopkins operated for years, edited and put together the Experimental Musical Instruments magazine, EMI, and you can still order back issues of that. And it's filled with phenomenal stuff on instrument invention. There's so much stuff in there that I was like, I don't want to see that because I want to pretend like I'm the only one. But he has put out a CD that I'm on called Orbitones, Spoon Harps, and Bellophones. And that was my big claim to fame because it had famous people in it. So it kind of like put me in their presence. Has Stomp and John Cage and
Tom Waits
and Aphex Twin and all of these cool people. So he's been really great to me. Just kind of helping spread the word about what I'm doing and stuff. I do a bit of instruments from found objects and teach children a lot how to make instruments. And so I've come up with a line of instruments made out of yogurt cartons, film vials, glass jars, balloons, stuff like that. And I've got wind instruments, stringed instruments, and percussion instruments all made out of those materials that I help children to make.
Styrofoam,
that horrible stuff that is so wonderfully resonant. Okay, I'll play, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a song in the old style, which is kind of like pre-Indian music learning on this instrument, the stamen bone. Here, and I've also got some CDs if you're curious. This is the Singing Stones that I was talking about with all the rocks, so take a look at that. And we'd be glad to answer more questions in a more informal, individual basis. Mm-hmm.
Our show's at On the Boards the 17th, 18th, and 19th.
What's it called?
Rhythm of the Landscape.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Little Vision. Yeah.